Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we will be speaking with Edgar Heap of Birds. He's an artist and professor of Native American Studies who will be at the Santa Fe Art Institute tonight. Right now, I am delighted to welcome three Jerusalem women, and they are in a speaking tour called Jerusalem Women Speak, Three Women, Three Faiths, One Shared Vision. They will be tonight in Albuquerque at the University of New Mexico, at the Commons in Mesa Hall at the UNM campus, and then tomorrow evening they will be here in Santa Fe at the Santa Fe Art Institute, Tipton Hall, from 6 to 8 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, ladies.
Good morning.
It's wonderful to have you all here. Wejdan Jaber is a Muslim Palestinian from Gaza. Abir Kopti is a Christian Palestinian who's a citizen of Israel. And Hagit Ra'anan is a Jewish Israeli. And how did the three of you come together to do this?
Yeah, actually, thank you for having us on your radio show this morning. We were invited by Partners for Peace, American organization based in D.C., and they're doing this tour since 1998. This is the 14th tour of its kind, and we were invited to come and take this tour and to speak to the American public, people in different states. We were only invited based on that we all share a vision of peace and that the land will be shared between Palestinians and Israelis.
Did any of you know each other before this tour?
No, well, actually, this is the intention of Partners for Peace. They bring women who do not know each other before, and the first time we meet here in the U.S., and this was very interesting experience for us. We, three of us, work on our own way to make peace. We are activists, each one in different organizations, and we come here to share our vision and to share our experience in working for peace.
So we'll go one at a time. Hagit Ra'anan, you're a Jew from Israel. Well, tell us a little bit about your life story and how you got involved in peace work.
I will try to be very briefly, as I mean, I have many years behind me already, so I will start with where my parents brought to Israel by them. Parents, my grandparents brought my parents both on 1923. My mother's family comes from Russia and my father's from Poland. Already at that time my grandfather felt that it's not so safe for the Jewish people there. Being a Zionist, he managed to convince his family and my grandmother's family to immigrate, to come to Israel. So they did. My father was at that time 6 months old, and he managed to convince everybody. Only one of my grandmother's sister was not convinced. So I never met her because she didn't survive the Holocaust. So maybe it started already there. And then again, I mean, next stop which was like a turning point in my life was in June 1982. Where my beloved partner for life got killed by Palestinian in Beirut, and that make me, like, after a while, a process of inner search and finding the message within myself that peace starts within. That, I mean, that happened, and that is for me to practice and to help others to find the peace within and meet others without judging and without knowing who is right and who is wrong, just to know each other.
The process of coming to peace within after you've lost your husband must be a very difficult one. How did you go about that?
That was a long process that that I mean, we don't have enough time to share it into details, but the idea is that one can choose allow the pain to paralyze it and not to do anything, and then again there is another way to do it and use it as like fuel, like to energize you to move forward and try to stop those kind of events of all sides, of all people, because we are all one, as I see it.
Weshtan Shaver, you are from Gaza. Tell us where you were born and raised and how your life has taken you to this tour now.
Yeah, I was born in 1968 in Gaza, 1 year after the Israeli occupation of Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And that means I was born and lived all my life under the Israeli occupation, and that wasn't easy life at all. I felt that it's always difficult for Palestinian people to think about peace while they are struggling for their daily life in the West Bank and Gaza, and with all the difficulties they are facing. But still, that means that days will pass and years will pass, and our children will have the same life, which I hope it's not going to happen. So I was hoping for a better life for our children, and this is why I'm thinking that a peaceful and just solution for the conflict should happen. Also, I was born disabled, and as a woman with disability, I grew up and received so much help from my family and friends and community, and I feel that it's my turn now to give back to my community. This is why I'm involved with young people activities and women's rights movement, and I think that all these classes or categories of the Palestinian community will never have a normal life and their full rights unless the Israeli occupation is over, and I think it must be over soon.
So you grew up under the Israeli occupation. Did you know Israeli people?
Not until recently. Recently, I met, start to meet Israeli women in conferences. I attended a couple of conferences for the women from the Mediterranean region, and I attended some lectures for Competence for Peace. This is the Competence for Peace. They are the some Israeli army or soldiers who laid off their weapons and refused to do the military service in the occupied territories. And that was very powerful movement. And now here I meet Hagit, and we're living together, and we have so many discussions, and we agree and sometimes disagree on some issues, but that means that if we can make it, if we can live together as Palestinian and Israeli women, so I think that the two nations can do it.
Abir Kopti, tell us a little bit about your life story and how you came into this work.
Yes, well, actually, I have a little bit different experience than Wishdan, because I'm also Palestinian, but I live inside Israel. And in Israel, 20% of the population are Palestinians, holding Israeli citizenship and Israeli passports. So my life is a bit different than Wishdan, but still I feel I'm Palestinian. I feel belong to the Palestinian nation and part of the Palestinian struggle to end the occupation and for just peace. But on the other hand, I live inside Israel, and I have my own struggle for full equal rights inside Israel, because also the Palestinian minority inside Israel is discriminated by the Israeli state. And because I live inside Israel...
What's that discrimination like?
Well, I can give some examples, because there is a state-level discrimination and the street-level discrimination and racism. We are seen inside Israel as the enemy, as the threat, as Arabs and Palestinians, and we're always quite often also demonized. There is different laws which is legislated in the Israeli Knesset that are racist in their nature. For example, one of the biggest organizations in Israel that control, its official organization that controls the lands in Israel, it's not allowed to send to sell lands to Arabs by law. It was legislated. So I am limited. I cannot buy most of the lands of the state. I cannot attend them or buy them because I'm limited by law. The other example is one of the laws which is citizenship law and the entry to Israel. And the example that I do is that I give often is that if I want to marry a guy from the occupied territories as Palestinian and he's Palestinian, I'm not allowed to bring him to live with me inside Israel in my own village or city. Whether I go to live with him in Gaza or Ramallah or whatever, or we live separated. And the law was legislated in Israel after the after many families, over 20,000 families, were already married and have children and living inside Israel, and they were forced to be separated, and now they are separated. So, and also the budget of the state, the development budget of the state, we are 20% of the population, but we receive only 3 to 5% of the development budget, which affect also infrastructure, welfare, education, and different aspects of life.
So that means your schools aren't as good, things like that?
Exactly. The education is affected by this. There is a lack of classes. Our classes are crowded by numbers of students. Our options for scholarships and different issues is limited. But then what I'm trying to say here is, in spite of all this, we are still finding a way to live with Israelis because we're living inside Israel. And my experience, the way I see work is, and activism is partnership, building partnership and removing walls building between us, not only cement walls, but also psychological walls that the occupation machinery is putting between us. So my activism in Israel is to remove all kinds of wall between me and Jewish people and a bit among Jewish people themselves, because there are different walls of course among between rich people and poor people. And this way I connect all things together, and I'm also involved in the women's struggle in my community, because my responsibility towards my community is also to be able to criticize my own community and to fight for my own rights as women inside my own community.
Let's talk about some of the political barriers to peace, and I think there are also emotional barriers to peace. When this subject of Israel and Palestine comes up in the United States in conversation, there is a tremendous amount of emotion that is manifested. Hagi, what do you think are the greatest political barriers that need to be overcome, and also emotionally?
It's easier for me to speak about the emotional one, first of all, because I believe that the political issues can find their solutions. I mean, all of them. There is not one problem that cannot be solved, to my understanding. I'm talking about the emotional barriers, which are deeper than the political issues. I often say that I have no enemies but fear itself, and that is what in domain in the two societies. The two societies doesn't know not even one day of peace since decades and decades. So this is where I come from, and this is my mission, to prepare the people to be able to experience and to believe that there is a way to live different than what we know.
You said the barrier of fear. I think that both sides carry a lot of fear. What are people scared of from the Jewish perspective, the Jewish-Israeli perspective?
Of course, you know, the paranoia of anti-Semitism all over the world. And the Shoah, the Holocaust, is already over than 60 years behind us. This is still there. And the Jewish people are afraid not to have a place of their own, that it's safe for them no matter what. And I mean, they can always go there. So this is the idea behind the idea of having a state, a Jewish home, like a home for the Jewish nation.
And so there you are, surrounded by potentially hostile neighbors all around you. Mm-hmm. Does it feel safe?
No, but they still want to be together. This is why I believe that, especially now, more and more people inside Israel knowing already that they will have to pay a price sometimes, like to give up on dreams that they had and carried for centuries, if not thousands of years. So they will have to have what they have and not to dream of something which is impossible and not allowing them to live in peace. So more and more people already agreeing on that, and it's almost a common agreement amongst the people that there is a price that the more and more are ready to pay for it.
Wejdan, when you look at political and emotional barriers to peace, what do you see? What do you think is the most important?
The most important political barrier is the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza, and this has to be removed and end soon, because Palestinians should have their independent vital state, and then when Palestinians, they are controlling their lives, their own lives, and they have the self-determination, then they can go more to towards peace with Israel as a neighboring country, because if they don't control their lives and every little aspect of their daily lives is controlled by the policies and military orders of the Israeli army, then they will not be able to comprehend and accept peace.
What is your personal experience with the Israeli army?
I didn't have actually so many good experiences, so most of the time I'm as a Palestinian I have to go through so many checkpoints and barriers, and those checkpoints, they are separated all over the West Bank. It's separating Palestinians from Palestinians. It's not only separating Palestinian from Israelis. It's not on the borders. They are between the Palestinian cities and villages and towns. So I have to go to work. I have to cross many Israeli checkpoints, and always we have to wait for hours. And if we are lucky, we can cross. If not, with the arbitrary rules that change every day for crossing procedures, sometimes we have to go where we come from, and this continuous hassle of the Palestinian lives at checkpoints and the humiliation, it's causing so much anger among the Palestinian people. And also the life in Gaza Strip is controlled totally by the Israeli army, because still Gaza is turning to be a big prison for 1.8 million Palestinians who are living in the Gaza Strip, because Israel is controlling the borders and all the crossing points, the movement of people and goods and food and medicine, and the supplies of electricity, water and fuel. And every time the Israeli army is using a new method of collective punishment, they are punishing the whole population of the Gaza Strip, sometimes by cutting the electricity for more than 1 or 2 days, and sometimes by cutting fuel, preventing people from easy movement, and people can't get outside, in or out of Gaza, for since months now. And actually, before I come here, I was lucky that I was in the West Bank, because if I was still living in Gaza, I wouldn't be able to be here today and to leave Gaza to come to the United States and to talk to people in the United States.
Abir Kopti, you have been involved in television, in media. What do you think the media in the United States and the media in Israel are doing well in reporting, and where do you think they are falling short?
Well, I think the media in Israel and in the U.S. are paying a lot of attention to the conflict in the Middle East. But on the other hand, most of the attention goes to the violent actions, and we can't see a lot of storytelling about the peace initiatives and the peace, the work for peace that people are doing on the ground. So the media more or less supporting violence because it's only showing violence and not supporting peace because there is a lot of peace engagement. But what I wanted also to say is, and you asked your question about the fear producing, and I think it's very common between the Israeli media and the American media, because back in Israel, and I worked a lot with the Hebrew media, with the Israeli media, and most of the time the Israeli media is producing fear. The government through the media is producing fear all the time among the Israelis, so they would legitimize whatever the government is doing in the name of the security. But this excuse of security can be refuted very easily, because many of the checkpoints and barriers are not between Israelis and Palestinians, are among Palestinians themselves, preventing Palestinians from going to their schools, work, universities, etc. And the same with the separation wall, the cement wall that is being built. It's also built in many cases on the Palestinian land, separating Palestinians from Palestinians, and in many cases crossing the same neighborhood, separating families from each other. So this is what makes the Israelis legitimize, because they are always have this fear. But I want also to remind Hagid that we're also, the Arabs are Semitic, so there is no fear. We are also facing this anti-Semitism. It's also toward us as Arabs. The thing is that, and the Palestinians have nothing to do with anti-Semitism movement. They have to do with the occupation. And of course, there is no trust between communities, and we cannot equalize between the occupier, those who have power, the Israelis, and those who are living under occupation. And their life is controlled on daily basis. Of course, both societies are paying the price for what the Israeli government is doing because of the occupation. But we cannot equalize, because people cannot function in the Palestinian society. They cannot function as a free society, as independent society. So the first step would be really to end the occupation and then allow both societies to meet each other and to have this process to learn how to live to each other. Because currently, Israelis and Palestinians cannot even meet because the occupation is preventing them from meeting. So the Palestinian meet only the army. So for the Palestinian, the Jewish people are the army, are presented in the soldiers who are oppressing them. And for the Israelis, the only Palestinians who they meet, or maybe those who are doing violent actions, but joint actions, and we try always to make joint Palestinian and Israeli actions for peace. And it's not always shown in the media, because the media is marginalizing our action. And I just want to say another comment, because I've been to this is my first visit to the U.S., and I watched a little bit TV, and I saw the same thing here. There is a producing fear all the time through programs and series and soaps, demonizing the Arabs and the Muslims. And I ask the American people not to generalize and look at the Arabs as a whole, because this is a wall that the U.S. administration is building between the Americans and the world, between the Americans and the Arab world, between the Americans and the Muslim world. And Americans also should share with us responsibility to remove this psychological wall being built based on fear. Hagi.
Yeah, I would like to add that, yes, Abir is right, because we are all the children of Sam, so they cannot be anti-Semitized Arabs against Jewish. But on top of the anti-Semitism, excuse me, that caused the paranoia amongst my people, there is also the hatred, as you mentioned before, of all the Arab nations around us and the Arabs out of the region. Ahmadinejad is not a very great help.
He's not an Arab, by the way.
No, I don't know. It's an Arab country anyway.
It's not an Arab country. Iran is not an Arab country.
Okay, he is, never mind. Ahmadinejad, with his brilliant point of view and messages, is not helping for the Jewish people to feel safe. Also about the fear that exists in the older society. Yeah, I agree. I mean, the Palestinian media is not trying to calm it down. On the opposite, You can watch there on some of the Palestinian TV and radio. They broadcast event, horrible pictures into very, like, to its smallest detail again and again and again. And this is not a very calming way. This is the thing that we are facing. I'm a member of the Israeli-Palestinian form of the bereaved families. And as such, I mean, the forum holds like 500 families on both sides, Israelis and Palestinians, all faith, all culture, the two nations. And in spite of all the difficulties, we come together because we come together really with peace and to share our message with the rest of the people there. Convince them that we made, if we were able, in spite of the pain and the price that each of us paid, to believe in peace and to do whatever in our hands in peaceful ways that can work. And we manage, in spite of the lows, we manage to meet often and to do work together as equal.
Now, the as you pointed out, the media tend not to carry stories about peacemaking. At this table, without my even seeking it out, there have been numbers of people who were involved in the Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking process, always on an individual level, as opposed to, I mean, I haven't had diplomats and government officials here. It's always people involved in either teenagers or young people or people of all ages doing this process. What is each of your perception of how, even in a small drop-by-drop way, effective that process has been?
Yeah, in the Palestinian community, we are working towards peace. As you said, little efforts and great efforts are made here and there. Sometimes with this, we have summer camps for Palestinian children. We can't meet with Israeli children, but the whole concept of these summer camps are based on building a peaceful culture for the Palestinian people. For children, we teach them that the life of the children in the rest of the world is always happy and colorful, and it's not always killing and shooting, because what they hear, the Palestinian children, what they hear all the time is this bloody images and shooting and firearms all the time, and they are very stressed and traumatized. So when they gather in these summer camps or childhood centers, they either paint or do handcrafts or play music to release the stress and the fear that they are facing every day, and they don't know how to cope with it. So I think this is one example of small efforts that the Palestinians are doing according to their resources, what they can do. I think also the Palestinian people every day, they're surviving every day the difficulties from the Israeli occupation, even go to work peacefully, even surviving with having to provide for their families food and medicine. This is kind of a peaceful, silent, peaceful movement, because with all the frustration and the pressure and the killing they are and home demolitions that they are facing every day, if they can still conduct a daily life and struggle for their daily life, I think this is a peaceful action.
Do you, Amir, see the seeds of peace growing into healthy trees?
Yes, of course. I believe that people have the power. I count on the people's power and to make a change and to affect the leaders. Because if you want to wait for the leaders, I don't think we will we will manage, because the leaders need our impact and we have to put a pressure on the leaders. In Israel and in Palestine, there is a lot of initiatives being done. I think among Palestinians also, internal work is being done also because of the recent fights, internal fights between among Palestinians. And I know many friends in Palestine who are trying to do work between the Hamas and the Fatah factions that fought each other. I know many friends who are doing non-violent training actions among Palestinians. And I know many friends who are trying to do joint actions between Palestinians and Israelis. One of the great examples for this is Bil'in village, because there have been for more than a year now, I think more even, at every week joint action between Israelis and Palestinians. Every Friday they go there and they demonstrate, protest the separation wall. And it's every Friday, every week, Israelis and Palestinians come together. It's not the easiest thing, as I mentioned before, to meet each other. But also inside Israel, there is a lot of movements. Everyone work on each, on his or her each way. It's varied between radical left and Zionist left. There is people who make dialogue meetings. There is people who refuse to go to the army. This is how they see their way to affect the Israeli society and show there is something is wrong with the occupation machine. And there is women organizations. I'm also active in Women Coalition for Just Peace, where we work Jewish and Palestinian women together. So there's a lot of actions being done on the ground. It's marginalized, of course, by the media. Then, and its impact not always can reach the government. But I believe that every single small action here or there can bring, could be a part of a big mosaic that will, at the end of the day, it will make a difference.
I got an email from a listener a few days ago who somehow knew that you were going to be on the air, and he said the following. He said, Partners for Peace, which is what the tourist group sponsoring you all, unfortunately is not truly interested in promoting peace. Rather, it's a propaganda machine whose sole purpose is to bash Israel and demonize it. Partners for Peace will present only its one-sided, out-of-context faux discussion. Have you had responses like this from people when you go on tour?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I mean, I cannot completely contradict that person, whoever sent it. I do understand where it comes from. Still,
where does it come from?
Part of the paranoia of, I mean, like, you see that even, like, simple words that when we use them, we need to know that that might evoke anger in one part of this side or the other of the society. And... like, I'm being born as a Jewish, raised up in Israel, as an Israeli. I'm very sorry that along all this tour, and because of maybe that's the way it was presented for the people, not in a very balanced way, I do regret that we couldn't reach any of the Jewish communities here in Israel. Sorry, in the United States. I mean, I met some Jewish people that...
So this group is not able to reach Jewish communities?
For some reason, it doesn't work. I mean, we were not able to visit any of the Jewish communities here. We were not welcomed by any of them. And I do regret, because I do want my people to listen to some different point of views and to meet my friends. Both Abir and Wajdan coming from different culture, and listen to them, what they have to say, and just maybe to be convinced that it's possible, the three of us sit together, bringing a message of hope. And I just hope that even the local Jewish community here in Santa Fe will find the time to come and meet us tomorrow
night at Tipton Hall at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, thank you.
Abir.
Yeah, I wanted to comment on that because I disagree. I think there were many Jews who came to our meetings, and I met personally many Jewish people, American Jewish, attended me and talked to me about peacemaking, and they really respected our point of views. Although they disagree, they might disagree, and this is fine. I don't think that this the Partners for Peace is an organization that is promoting peace. And many Jewish, I think, organizations...
You do or don't think it is?
I think that it Partners is. For Peace, because we three of us coming here to talk about peace, and you heard us, and I think your listeners heard our ambition for peace. We're not here to fight each other, we're here to work together. And we believe it's possible. I think many organizations in the U.S. who are a Jewish organization that do not want to host us, it's because we use the terminology of occupation. And I'm so sorry, but I cannot give up facts on the ground. I ask every American to go and look for facts. There is occupation on the ground, and I think three of us, Hagit and Wujdan, agreed among us that we all work in different way to end the Israeli occupation. So whether people like it or not, it's there. The occupation is there, and we ask people to come and listen to us because we really have a message for peace. But we believe peace cannot be possible without ending control of people on other people.
Yeah, I do agree that the situation presently is under the title of occupied territory. Still, there is a mass of people. Don't call it occupation. They call it deliberation. And this is also a fact, historical fact. This is the difference between the narratives. And this is something we need to find a way to bridge upon. So when you come and say occupation, so, I mean, you allow only people on that side of the map to come, and if you will say deliberation, those will never show up and the others will come. So we need to be very careful with the words, and facts are different in the two different narratives, and we just need to respect it, and we can do that.
Well, unfortunately it's time to go. I'd like to give each of you just another minute to talk about if there's anything else that you would like the American people or the Santa Fe listeners to know right now before we go. Wujdan.
Yeah, I want to approach the people in Santa Fe and all the listeners that we are, as a human being, Palestinians, Israelis, American, and all human beings, we are holding responsibilities towards what's going on in Palestine and Israel. And the American public people should question what they receive from the media, and they should look for facts. And they have to stand up for their points of views, and they have to make their voice heard. If they believe that this abuse of the human rights for the Palestinian people is just unfair, then this is not the brotherhood and sisterhood in humanity.
Knowing that peace dwells in the heart, in all hearts, all cultures, all faith, all nations, I just want to share that peace prevails on earth. In Hebrew we state Shalom, Yishre Shalom al Adama. In Arabic, Asalam Lilalam Ajma. And I do believe in it. I know we can have it soon, that we can dream or imagine.
I would say to the listeners, mainly, because we're here to talk to the listeners, don't be afraid to discover another side of facts, to see the whole picture and to discover other information. It's very important for us. We're here because mainly people hear one side of the story, and we're here to bring another side of the story. So please come to our events and listen to the other side of the story, and then we trust your judgment.
I want to thank you all so much for being with us, Hagit Ra'anan, Abir Kopti, and Wejdan Jaber. And they will be in Santa Fe tomorrow night at the Santa Fe Art Institute at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall. They will also be tonight in Albuquerque at the University of New Mexico Center for Women's Studies program at the Commons in Mesa Hall on the UNM campus. Thank you so much for spending all this time with us.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Thank you. We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Edgar Heap of Birds. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Edgar Heap of Birds. He's an artist and professor of Native American Studies and Fine Arts at the University of Oklahoma, and he will be here tonight in Santa Fe at Tipton Hall, sponsored by the Santa Fe Art Institute, and will be teaching a workshop Tuesday through Friday of this week. And Diane Karp joins us, director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. Let's talk about your work. You do various different kinds of work. You do drawings and paintings, and you do Are they called public interventions, kind of public art?
Yes, yes. And it, for me, it reflects multi-dimensions of everybody, that one art practice. It's kind of a European model of the masterwork. And so for Native people and for everybody else, we have maybe four or five parts of our personality. So my multiple views of art reflects my personality in many ways. So I do drawings, paintings, public art pieces. You know, I did some glass work in Murano in Italy recently. So I have a lot of different kind of ways to express myself.
You are coming from very much a Native perspective on the genocide here in this continent. Nice. How do you express that work through your art? Some of it is direct and some of it is maybe more indirect.
Well, for me, I'm from the Cheyenne Nation and Southern Cheyenne in Oklahoma. And I think for me, the really practical sensibility about dealing with history and genocide, for us, it goes back even to our social dances when we have a powwow ceremonial kind of gathering, which is more like a social ceremony. We're there to first honor the people that have died. So there are honor songs, memorial songs sung first before anyone else dances. And then once we have the memorial song exchanged, then everyone can dance. So for me, as I travel the world and work on my projects in public art, I often find, you know, people that have been murdered or executed or died under duress during the colonial era, and I want to sing that memorial song first. Then after that's done, we move on to make different kind of art projects and, you know, kind of a common day, but we have to make that honoring ceremony first.
So when you move on from the honoring ceremony to different kinds of art projects, are these communal, done together?
Yeah, well, we're doing one here this week. I'm working with Institute of American Indian Arts students, and we have maybe 8 to 10 students coming to work with me to create new public art projects, interventions from their own personalities, and we're going to exhibit them on the walls of the museum downtown on the plaza. And we're going to be outdoors on these bar walls. We're going to tie the work up there, and it'll be available to all the tourists that walk by and anyone that's in the plaza. And they're going to make brand new work. So I'm going to give them, you know, a lot of prompting, a lot of history of contemporary art. And we're going to look at all kinds of art, not Native art, I mean, per se. We're going to look at all kinds of colleagues that I have around the world. And then hopefully inspire them to express themselves in a public way.
How do you see people's reactions to the public art you do? Do you watch to see them looking?
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And it has all kinds of ways to exchange and extend itself, you know. An artist has to realize that when you make the work, it's just the first step. And you put it out in the world, and it has a life of its own. It's been exchanged by many, many people. I had a piece against the baseball team in Cleveland, and it was said "Smile for Racism," and it had the logo of Chief Wahoo in kind of an angry face, and they censored that billboard in Cleveland. They said I was appropriating their images, which was kind of ironic in the
I should say so, since you
images.
Were protesting their appropriation.
Right,
your...
they said it was infringement on the copyright.
Oh,
but anyway, we challenged that, and we got it overturned. But as it became inflammatory, which is always kind of a mission of public art, and to be inflammatory on some level, it becomes newsworthy. And when it's newsworthy, it's then replicated in the news media. You know, so your work is then being exchanged for free to the public. But in this case, it was in Baseball Weekly magazine, the billboard itself. So the baseball fans had to engage the idea. And that's the mission of public art, is to make the engagement, not to really be persuasive or overturn ideas per se, just to kind of make that issue put on table and have it be looked at.
Did you get any feedback from the people who read the baseball magazine? I mean, I would think that it would probably be presented in a way that wasn't necessarily favorable to you,
yeah,
although
that,
I don't know.
Well, they would be, you know, unhappy with it initially, but then they started to consider the issues of race and identity and someone taking away their identity by making a replica of them. So it became a time to really consider, and I think it was effective.
We're talking to Edgar Heap of Birds. Tell us about some of the other public art projects you've done. You do a lot of work using signs that are the same type of material as typical road signs.
Yeah, and I really believe in that kind of way of communication, you know, that, and it's sort of a sly way in a sense where we always believe a sign. And when a sign goes up, and the sign is always an editorial, no matter what it is. You know, you have sort of monument signs or historical signs, and someone wrote them from a point of view. We take them as face value, as truth. And so I challenge the world by making my own signs And I make heavy editorials, and they believe them.
What are some examples?
Well, I had a piece in New York at the State University of New York at Purchase, New York, which is by White Plains. And the sign said Purchase in a big words. Below it said stolen, reclaimed, you know. And those kind of words were there, like mile markers.
The word Purchase is kind of a setup.
Right. So New York, stolen, reclaimed. And it was green like an interstate sign. And we put it right when you came into campus. And you come in to Purchase, you know. And when I was there working, they didn't have a bill of sale for their land. They just stole it from the tribes that were there, obviously. So if it was stolen and there's no receipt for it, then you can reclaim it, per se, you know. So I do kind of play with those words and the context of the signs, you know. My project right now that's very exciting is the one for the Venice Biennale. And it's called Most Serene Republics. And it's been up since June in Venice. And it's the biggest art fair in the world and kind of the most prominent art experience, I guess, in the world. Happens every 2 years. And I was selected to be one of the participants of that project. And so I researched warriors that were with Buffalo Bill Cody in the 1880s, 1890s, and found that 16 men and in that same group, 3 children died in Europe while being in Cody's charge. Some of them died as part of the Wild West Show experience. Some died as diseases. And they're buried all over Europe. So I researched their names and created memorials in Venice to all the people that died in those troops. And so we're now looking at how to repatriate the bodies back to America. And Cody didn't really write about that or disclose the deaths. And the USA had a bond issued from him to keep $20,000 so that he could take the Indians with him, you know, to Europe. And they took him out of prison outside of Chicago after the ghost dance, you know. So they were pretty much under duress and all these problems and made them perform all over Europe. And so my work dealt with that because they came to Verona and in Venice they were there. And so the spectacle of the Wild West show was very much like the art fair spectacle that happens today. And natives have always been involved in these spectacles, as I was as a representative in Venice.
Well, that's something I was really wondering about your work and your experience of your work is there you are, an insider in a way in this art system, but criticizing the larger system.
Yeah, and I think it's important to have that ability or talent to be with the art system. I mean, I like I said before, with the students I'll teach this week, I'm very much versed in contemporary art in all kinds of, not race, but about all kinds of techniques, and I am a contemporary artist, and my themes vary, but they always deal with politics and identity. I've worked also in South Africa, I worked in Australia.
But I mean, how do you keep from being just the 21st century Buffalo Bill show Indian?
Well, that's how I challenged that stereotype when I went to Italy, you know, is to actually go there and sing that memorial song, rather than go there and make a exhibit about myself. I don't really do that. I went there to acknowledge the deaths, you know. Whereas everyone else that went there would make their own work and have a pavilion and just say, aren't I wonderful, here's what I do.
Right.
And I think the challenge of the contemporary artist is to be in context. That's the real challenge, and not to be egotistical and an individual. I think you need to have your work pay homage to where you go. And if you leave your home, you should address where you're going and look at the history that's there.
You're speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall on the campus of the College of Santa Fe. What are you talking about?
I'm going to show a lot of the Venice Biennale project. We made 2 short films when we were there. And I also was very privileged to make glass, a glassworks in Murano. It's an island off the coast of Venice. Wonderful island, and it's a very kind of isolated spot. It's very traditionally for glass done, and they have their own dialect, not really Italian per se. And so they're almost like a marginalized tribe within Italy. And then they were happy to participate in the Biennale because no one ever asked them, because they were sort of underclass people.
You're kidding. The Murano glass people were never invited
to.
No.
They said, no one ever talks to us about this. And so I came over and we made new pieces, and we made these huge vases that have 16 figures going on the outside, represent the 16 deaths. And they're like 1 foot tall, thick glass vases in different colors. And I'm really happy to have that work, you know, accomplished. So I have a film that shows me making that work, too.
Well, Edgar Heap of Birds, thank you very much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe, and we hope to have you on the show again someday soon.
Well, thanks a lot. It's great to be here.
And Diane Karp, sitting very quietly with us, director of the Santa Fe Art Institute. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Fran Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen to it, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta la vista. We'll see you tomorrow. Ciao.